Welcome to the Charleston School of Law podcast. I'm your host, John Struble. We are available on iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and streaming through our website at charlestonlaw.edu/podcast. Our guest today is Charleston Law Professor Allison Haynes Stewart. She teaches privacy and e-discovery law here at the law school, as well as contracts, civil procedure, and evidence, and those courses here at the Charleston School of Law. Allison, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, John. It's my pleasure.
So your bio states that prior to joining the faculty ranks here, you worked as a director in the legal department at Sony. How long were you there? Can you give us a little thumbnail sketch of your background?
Sure. I was at Sony Corporation of America for about 2 years after I practiced at a law firm in New York City, Cleary Gottlieb Steen & Hamilton.
Okay.
It was also in New York City. So I went in-house at Sony, and it was a fantastic position. I loved being in-house. I loved that perspective of having a single client, and thoroughly enjoyed it, and probably would have stayed longer if it had not been that this law school opened in 2004. And so I was really happy to come back.
We'll get to that in just a minute. I wanted to ask you, you spent 2 years there. Now, when we say Sony, I think of music and electronics and artists and things. Is that what you were working on?
So I wasn't doing quite the most sexy aspects of Sony. Sony Corporation of America is the parent for pictures and PlayStation and music. My claim to fame is I actually did get to see Beyonce in the elevator, but never actually worked closely with her. Instead, we did a lot more of the corporate kind of stuff.
Okay.
I went to undergrad in North Carolina, and then I came back to South Carolina for law school when it only had the one. And after that, I went to Cleary Gottlieb's. Well, first, I clerked for Judge Norton here in Charleston. So that was an amazing experience, a two-year federal clerkship. And then after that, I went up to New York and worked at Cleary Gottlieb Steen & Hamilton. I was there for a while, about 5 years, and genuinely loved it. Burned the candle at both ends. Got everything I could have out of being a single in New York City, and I loved it.
Sweet.
I really did, yes.
Yeah, that's a dynamic place. And either you love it or you just, no, this isn't for me.
Right. I think that everybody should live for a little while in a place like just, it's a great experience for sure.
When you came to Charleston School of Law, did you arrive on day one when they first opened?
Yes. I did my job talk with a cardboard box as a podium. I was kind of giving it to a video camera because a lot of the people who were making decisions weren't there. Yes, they were hiring for the incoming class. And so I was the first to teach contracts here. And the first year I taught everybody contracts. And Nancy Zisk taught everybody torts, and she's still here as well. So we have fond memories of day one. Yes.
Yeah. How cool is that? And you've seen the growth over 20 years and the ups and downs and challenges.
I've seen all of it, the good, the bad, and the ugly, yes. But we've made great strides, and I'm very, very proud of where we are and where we've come from.
Let's talk about your new research on privacy and discovery rights, which was published in the George Mason Law Review. It's titled, A Right to Privacy for Modern Discovery. If there are listeners who are like, oh, here we go. I've never been to law school, but I was fascinated by this subject matter. One, in the warmth of your writing and the way it was written, a lot of the content applies to everyday people. So as we discuss this, what is your process for selecting subject matter when it comes to research?
Well, thank you for all those kind words, John. I appreciate it. Without making the story too long, I'll just say that I actually became interested in privacy back when I was at Sony.
Okay.
This is when there were a lot of laws being passed for the first time that were regulating online privacy and other things like that, and I was working on our websites and everything. So I came into academia with a perspective of wanting to work in privacy. And then, of course, I started teaching and first I looked at privacy in the context of contracts because I was teaching contracts. And mm-hmm. so I first started writing on online privacy policies. And then other things that I taught, it would pique my interest in privacy with respect to those aspects as well. So I was teaching civil procedure and personal jurisdiction. So I started looking at internet jurisdiction and that kind of thing. But I've also, as a parallel, been interested in electronic discovery. And that's something that we had the Federal Courts Law Review here at the law school, and early on we're doing seminars, symposia, dealing with e-discovery, talking to a lot of federal magistrate judges who were making decisions about e-discovery admissibility. And so I've been intrigued with e-discovery for a while. Mm. And so this is kind of, you know, a compendium of both my interest in privacy and my interest in discovery. And I think as technology has impinged on our daily lives more and more, mm-hmm. and discovery has included these kinds of devices and things that have the ability to implicate so much personal privacy, if they are disclosed, I've become more and more interested in that, and actually been frankly surprised that there hasn't been more emphasis on privacy with respect to discovery. When e-discovery became big, it was a lot of the focus for practitioners, for judges, for the people changing the rules was on how expensive it had become, how time-consuming it was. But they weren't really focusing that much on privacy interests. And so that's where I was looking. And then, two, in the Supreme Court, there was renewed interest or renewed focus on privacy in the Fourth Amendment criminal context for searches of things like cell phones, for the use of things like GPS and cell site records, and how that implicated privacy interests of criminal suspects. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of what the Supreme Court has said with respect to privacy of those kinds of technologies, I think, has also affected civil discovery. So all of that kind of came together in this article, and I really looked at the history, which I don't think anybody had really done that much yet. So I go all the way back to the original federal rules and look at any use of those rules to protect the privacy of discovery. Mm. And discovery, of course, is documents and other tools to get information from the other side in a civil lawsuit.
Where do you, I mean, that's an enormous undertaking in research when you go back to when this first originated and when you first became intrigued by it to now, because it's moving so fast. How are you able to get your head around that and kind of say, okay, I got to get this narrow enough so it isn't a book?
Right. It could be. so first, I did have help. I did have help of research assistants, which was wonderful. And this was a project that lasted a couple of years. It's something that has morphed over the years. And yes, as it developed, I kept going down rabbit holes, and really at the beginning it wasn't a historical view of privacy. At the beginning it was just a look at current sort of Internet of Things and how discovery of those kinds of devices was increasing. But then I just became interested in, you know, has anybody ever protected this from a privacy perspective? And so, yes, you're right at how big it became, because at the one hand, I'm looking back at tax returns and things like that in the 1940s up to Fitbits today. So, you know, and to an extent, it's a predictive thing as well, because this is only growing.
Yeah, and if you're doing it over a two-year period, things are shifting and changing as, I mean, technology moves that quickly. It's a fascinating subject matter, and I encourage our listeners, as you're thinking about this, consider how you use your mobile device, your desktop computer, when you flip on the GPS, allow it to track you, what that means and what that will reveal about you if you ever get into a situation. I began thinking that and getting kind of anxious. Not that I'm worried about any place I've been, but it's just like, what are the possibilities and where does it end? Especially in discovery, it seems like you could spend an enormous amount of time trying to unearth discovery when you're in a court case.
So. Right. And you think about people being concerned for their privacy vis-a-vis the government,
right.
Vis-a-vis, you know, any kind of police or things like that. But in reality, normal lawsuits implicate a lot of this stuff. And of course, I start my introduction with the discussion of just a run-of-the-mill slip and fall case and how the discovery in that case became so intrusive, including all social media, all text messages, all emails, all Fitbit device usage from a certain period of time. And that is opened up simply because someone claims physical injuries.
Right.
So it's like in our system, when you bring a lawsuit, you have in effect waived your right to privacy with respect to certain things as long as they're deemed relevant to the suit. So that's where it gets kind of broad, is with respect to someone saying that they have suffered mental or physical injury. That opens up a whole can of worms in terms of, well, what have you said about your mental or physical condition, either in social media or elsewhere? What does your Fitbit device say about your physical or mental condition?
Yeah, if you're working out every day, are you really physically damaged
exactly.
in any way? Yeah,
exactly. So those kinds of devices tell us a lot about that. And, you know, one of the things that I worry about, I don't talk about it as much in this piece, but I worry about the chilling of people bringing legitimate claims because of their worry that their rights to privacy will be infringed by the potential discovery.
I want to ask you about where you land on this personally, and just after we get into a couple more questions. But so you write about this disruption that technology has on the legal discovery process. In light of all this research and this publication that you have out now, can you address, summarize the challenges that technology has created in the legal industry?
Sure. So I think that, you know, technology can be wonderful. It can do great things. It can streamline things. You know, just think about how much easier it is to search a document for particular words using technology as opposed to just your eyes. But it has What it's really done in the context of discovery and other areas is it's enabled so much information that spans so many different types of aspects of a person's life to be held in one small place that they wear or carry with them everywhere they go. So, for example, in a lot of these lawsuits, people are seeking the actual cell phone of an opposing party, and they want to be able to do a forensic review of that cell phone. And if you think about all the information that's on a cell phone, you've mentioned GPS location tracking, apps, there's a ton of personal information.
As you start tapping, right. You're giving away information.
Right, right? Exactly. So I think that's part of it, is that technology has enabled so much information to be held on such a small device. And then, you know, there's also a challenge in the legal field because the law doesn't keep pace with technology. Mm. And so you often have judges who are kind of winging it with respect to new technology. You know, the first judge to decide whether Fitbit information is admissible or not, you know, it's a difficult thing. And so that's where I think that scholars and, you know, think tanks and other people out here need to be doing this research and need to be looking into these things and helping give courts guidance.
We discussed briefly about the time and effort put into unearthing some of this in the e-discovery process. Do law firms have the resources and wherewithal to go to that depth, or are they hiring? Is this creating tech firms that have an industry now created specifically to do that work for law firms?
That's a great question. And the answer is both. There is a huge e-discovery industry that has arisen in the last, 20 years or so that is in response to this. And so you have companies that are solely devoted to helping with e-discovery, to helping cull information from people's devices and laptops and things like that, helping search that data and put it in a way that is usable by the parties. And one of the things that the rules have done and the courts do are they're trying to get people to actually collaborate and cooperate and maybe together use e-discovery services and be able to kind of trust each other so that they can put stuff on the same platform and not have to spend too much money. But, not to go down a tangent, but you've seen some issues with that as well, with people disclosing things by mistake. So in the recent Alex Jones case, all of those text messages that were sent by mistake, those had been culled by an e-discovery vendor from his cell phone. And so you've got human error on top of what technology allows. But just to finish your previous question, so yes, there's this whole industry that's been built up, but then yes, law firms are also developing it in-house as well. So we have a lot of law firms that have their own e-discovery wing.
And does everyone do it differently or a variation, or are there standards in place already?
There are definitely standards in place.
Okay.
EDRM is sort of the gold standard of the way in which e-discovery is modeled. And so there is a lot out there in terms of best practices for e-discovery. The Sedona Conference is kind of like a think tank where you've got judges and practitioners coming together and discussing best practices. And again, I think that with technology and with discovery in particular, what we're going up against is a long history of the way that people do it, the way they do discovery. And so with the e-discovery technology, with using these vendors, it's a change in the way people practice, and that doesn't happen easily. So I think that a lot of what we're trying to do in terms of lower the costs and things is to get people to sort of trust that process, as opposed to insisting on, for example, eyes on review for attorney-client privilege. And when they don't want to do that, that's when the expense comes in, all the hours that it takes to review documents like that, as opposed to allowing them to be reviewed on a e-discovery platform.
It's kind of putting you on the spot right now, but do you trust that process in the way it is right now?
I do trust the e-discovery process. I think that there are a lot of ways that you can protect yourself, the belt and suspenders, as they say, that attorneys don't take enough advantage of. There are certain cooperation orders. There are orders that you can get the court to endorse this particular way of the discovery being produced, subject to confidentiality, that will protect you more. And so I think that parties need to take more advantage of the steps that are out there to protect yourself. That said, you can't completely give up your own protection. You can't just say, we're going to use this technology. We're not going to, keep our own duties to preserve the confidentiality of privilege or things like that. You still have to be very careful about how you go about reviewing the documents.
Has this, all this work you've done, the research you've done, the writing you've done, being around this subject matter in the legal industry, has it changed the way you look at technology and how you use technology?
I think the biggest change to my view of technology has been having a teenager, but but I think that I think I see I of course view everything through the lens of a privacy scholar, et cetera. So while some people might think, oh, cameras at stoplights, what a great idea! We'll know when people run a stoplight. I think, oh gosh, it's Big Brother.
Yeah.
So I do have a different perspective when it comes to that kind of stuff. But I do use a Fitbit. I do use a cell phone. I tend to say no to allowing the pop-up ads, no to allowing the tracking and things like that.
Okay.
But yes, I think my biggest fear is what it does to teenagers and you know, social media is a scary, scary thing.
Allison Haynes Stewart is our guest today on the Charleston School of Law podcast. We are talking about her new research that has been released and published in George Mason Law Review, titled A Right to Privacy for Modern Discovery. What is considered private and protected in discovery?
Wow.
Or should that be a whole nother podcast
right.
in itself?
It's still developing. I think that we can say, as opposed to criminal law, where it's the question, of course, is do you have a reasonable expectation of privacy? With respect to discovery, that's not the question. The question is it relevant or
okay.
not? The only true privacy in discovery is with respect to privilege. So there's attorney-client privilege, there's doctor-patient privilege, there's attorney work product. But otherwise, nothing is, by definition, off limits.
Wow.
Yeah, a diary is discoverable. And so instead, we have balancing tests. We have to convince the court that a particular document, a particular question crosses the line and is, you know, it's similar to evidence where you're weighing the probative value against any kind of prejudicial effect. Here you're weighing the relevance of it against the problems that it might lead to
okay.
against any kind of intrusion into someone's discovery.
Yeah. When you're teaching law students, is there, at their age, is their default to go toward electronic discovery or is it just, is that a fair question to ask?
Well, I think that students definitely understand the importance of, for example, email.
Okay.
I think that, you know, they understand how all of this stuff could be relevant. And so, you know, when we're learning about discovery in law school, we're looking at some things like sanctions and things like that. And so a lot of the case law has been dealing with emails and with the destruction of emails. And, you know, I think that students intuitively understand that people share things on email, perhaps
right.
that they don't, they wouldn't put in a letter. I mean, there's even been an email where someone said, you know, I wouldn't put this in writing, but, and you know, you're thinking to yourself,
you just did.
And that's even, right. This is technology and it's probably, more preserved than a document would be. So, a lot of people say things in email that they really shouldn't say.
And probably even more so text.
Right.
Because it's so informal.
Right. And I think that's a next level is text as well. And so again, you know, we have the case law kind of falls behind always. So emails, we have cases from about emails going back decades now, but then when it comes to text, when it comes to Fitbit, it's less and less in the case law, even though I think it's happening in practice.
So a little bit of application here. Based on your research, what should we know about sharing information in the digital world?
So I think that we should know that when you share information, you have no control over where it goes.
Most of it's all stored, right, Allison?
A lot of stuff
somewhere.
Is stored, yes. A lot of stuff is stored. It takes a lot of effort to actually delete something.
So deleting your history doesn't mean it's
right,
gone.
Right, right. and think about the fact that discovery is not just from that particular party. You have opponents who try to go to the source, for example, go to the actual email provider or go to the cell service provider and get information directly from them. We have a lot of cases where parties have asked their opponents to give them their social media passwords. And for a while, courts were saying yes, but that's completely the wrong approach. And, you know, you shouldn't require someone to give over all of their social media when not all of it is necessarily relevant. But by the same token, parties will go straight to Facebook or straight to, you know, Instagram or whatever it is when they're trying to get this information.
You wrote in your research, people's entire lives are chronicled by devices on their wrists or their countertops. So whether we're on social media, texting, email, surfing the web, wearing a Fitbit, using Alexa, almost every single person has some digital footprint that reveals who we are, what we do, when we do it. Should we be taking steps to protect our private information in the digital world?
Well, you make it sound kind of scary. The answer, I think, is yes. I think that there's a rush to the use of technology for its convenience, right? Everybody wants, oh, wow, our refrigerator can tell us when it's time to get more milk or whatever. But if you think about it, it also has the effect of, yes, chronicling all of your daily activities. You know, the police have used Alexa. They have their, if there is some kind of crime that takes place, they might try to get what Alexa might have picked up in terms of what it heard. You know, I think that we're moving towards a situation where you don't need people's testimony at all. Everything is going to be recorded on cameras or devices, and so we'll have digital witnesses without the necessity of anybody remembering anything, which is kind of scary. So I think, you know, be aware of it, yes. I think that most people think it's more important to them to have a Ring device that will record things that happen outside their house than it is to protect against someone else being able to tell when you were home all the time or things like that. But, you know, I think that to some extent it's hard to get across the message that your privacy is being invaded when people want technology sometimes for other purposes like convenience, like security.
Right.
It's hard for people to see, well, what's the problem? And, you know, there have been a lot of scholars out there that talk about this, how, you know, if you know you're being watched all the time, does that not change your behavior inherently?
Right.
And I don't know that we want to be the kind of society that has drone cameras outside our windows so we know to be careful of what we do or say. So, you know, I think we need to be careful how far we go with technology and to make sure that, you know, we are preserving these safe spaces where we can feel free to say or think or do anything we want.
Mm. I don't know if it was a radio talk show or a television talk show yesterday, but someone had made the point that every new home being built moving forward should be have a Ring system built into the house as part of like the way you build the house.
A complete smart house.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, and the more I thought about it, I'm like, good and bad.
Right.
I mean, there are both. You just have to weigh them. And
I think that, you know, certainly parents like the idea of being able to see what happens. You know, you go out of town, you want to be able to know, did they have a party while we were gone? things like that.
You kind of rolled your eyes there like
it's
well aware.
Personal experience coming back again. But so I think there are a lot of things that are attractive about this technology, about, you know, having something else monitoring your temperature and everything else. But be aware that all of that can be used against you if necessary. So the police can certainly subpoena that kind of stuff or get a warrant for it. And in civil discovery, if it's relevant, whether you were home or if it's relevant, you know, how many people you had over that particular night, you know, it can lead to crazy kind of intrusive discovery.
Yeah. After this 2 years worth of work on this, what were your takeaways for you from doing all the research?
So my takeaway really was that I was just beginning. There are so many aspects that I would like to follow up on.
Yeah.
One of the things that I thought was fascinating was my review of sexual harassment cases. And, you know, one of the another way I think that a litigant can open themselves up to intrusive discovery is if, for example, they a woman brings a sexual harassment case or a man, and then the defendant wants to get certain discovery in order to counter that claim and, and say maybe that the attentions were welcome or whatever it is. And so you see discovery being sought of information about a particular party's other relationships, other sexual activity, things like that. And so I see that as problematic. And one of the things I've seen that courts have done is bring in evidentiary protections and apply them in the discovery context, which is not ordinarily done. Ordinarily, discovery is much more broad than what you can have admissible at trial. So I want to look at that a little bit more. Obviously, now that the Supreme Court has passed Dobbs, I've been looking again at this issue and have another paper coming out that really kind of tries to crystallize whether Dobbs had any effect on a lot of what I've been writing about.
There's a lot more information in your research and more detail than we are discussing now. We are just kind of, you know, we're about a mile wide and about an inch deep on some of this stuff. But I want to thank you for taking the time to come on the podcast today and talk about this.
It's been my pleasure.
George Mason Law Review, and we will provide a link right below this podcast so you can access the actual research there. Thank you, Allison.
Thank you, John.